Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Well, today we're going to press on, having considered the United States last time. We're going to look at Canada, Australia, and India. And in each case, again, there are the political dimension, exactly as you might expect. There are financial questions, and there are the questions of what one might call the practicality of terrain and demand. So we'll start with Canada. And the immediate issue in the Transcontinental Railway scheme was British Columbia joining the Confederation of Canada, the idea being that Canada should thereby be anchored on the Pacific and that the British colony there should be, as it were, stabilized, not as part of America, because, of course, Polk had fought the election in 1844, the American election, on the idea that British Columbia must be part of the United States. On top of that, there was the hope of blocking the notion that the western portion of Canada would look for its rail links into the United States, and specifically to Chicago. And I think some of the back history is interesting. And the reason I say that is it's one of the things in which I'm very grateful to The Critic for allowing so much time, is that it enables one to move away from bland remarks like, and the Canadian Transcontinental Railway was built, bang, and then we move on to India and Australia. It enables one to pick out the fact that what we see as the easy building blocks of history were in fact shot through with problematics, with issues, all of which required debate and discussion, many of which were heavily politicized. And that is a way of suggesting that what we actually see in the present world is not necessarily too dissimilar. So there had already been a significant American presence in the Canadian system, in particular the Grand Trunk Railway, which was launched in 1852 to build a railway line between Montreal and Toronto. And as an aspect of British capital, its corporate headquarters were in London, in fact. The Grand Trunk Railway had leased the Atlantic and St. Lawrence Railroad in 1853, which gave it an extension to the harbour at Portland in Maine. In other words, it had become what had been initiated as a Canadian railway project within the British Empire, had in fact become an American-Canadian project in which the vulnerabilities of Canada, its dependence on American links, were more apparent. And indeed, on top of that, in 1859, the Grand Trunk established a ferry service across the St. Clair River to what is now Port Huron in Michigan. Now, what this meant is that as the 1860s began with the American Civil War breaking out in 1861 and great tension between the Union side and Britain in both 1862 and 1863, with possibility initially over the American seizure of a British Royal Mail steamer with Confederate envoys on board, the possibility of conflict or at least confrontation between Britain and the Union. This had not just immediate tensions in terms of the prospect of a Union invasion of Canada, because that's where the Union would be able to hit Britain, but it also meant an immediate implications for the railway. And one has to remember this, that many of the rail links that we see as part of the heritage of rail, arose from very specific geopolitical issues tied to what were perceived as strategic vulnerabilities. So the British government offered to underwrite a line from Halifax, Nova Scotia to Quebec, in large part for geopolitical reasons. It would mean that there was not the need for operating through to Portland and in Maine. That was seen as significant. It also reduced reliance on the St. Lawrence Waterway, which was again seen as vulnerable to American attack. And military plans in North America, both by the Union and by Britain, over the possibility of conflict, depended on either using or threatening rail links. So, for example, in 1861, Captain William Noble of the Royal Engineers produced a report on the defense of Canada, arguing that the American presence on the St. Lawrence Seaway was a direct threat to British communications. As a result, Noble pressed for Britain actually launching the attack if there was to be a war with America. Subsequently, this theme continued. Indeed, a very interesting dispatch I found in the Foreign Office papers from 1867 from Sir Frederick Bruce, the British envoy in Washington, writing to the Foreign Secretary, he wrote as follows. As population and industrial development increase in Minnesota, Montana, and other northwestern states which adjoin the British frontier, it is not difficult to foresee that the demand will arise for communication by the line of the Saskatchewan River, which is said to offer the greatest facilities for reaching the Pacific. In other words, the American northern states along the frontier will demand transit rights through British Canada. And if the provinces aided by, he means the Canadian provinces, aided by Great Britain are unable to meet it when it becomes necessary and show themselves incapable of providing greater facilities for the transit of produce from the Lake region through the St. Lawrence to the Atlantic, the desire of the United States to drive their British rivals off the continent will be powerfully reinforced by the material interests of the Northwest, which will be the Northwest of America, which will be enlisted in favor of conquest or annexation. Whether the policy adopted by Great Britain in the northern part of this continent contemplates provincial connection with the mother country, that's Britain, as a permanent relation, or looks to it merely as a step towards provincial independence in the future, its success will materially depend upon our ability to deal in a sufficiently liberal and comprehensive manner with the transit question. In other words, Sir Frederick Bruce is saying to the government in London, you need to sort out the financing of railways in Canada, or else the Americans will be taking over. And to that extent, the economic imperative was to the fore, but as part of a geostrategy. The British North America Act of 1867, a key element of the Canadian Constitution, duly included a provision for an intercolonial railway. In turn, in 1871, it proved necessary for the Canadian government to pressure its British counterpart to guarantee a loan for the transcontinental railway that was pledged when British Columbia entered the Canadian Confederation that year. The fact that America already had such a railway was regarded as a comparative disadvantage for Canada and therefore for the British Empire, as well as a model that required emulation. And there was a concern that without such a rail link, British Columbia would go into the ambit of America's Pacific coast, not least because the Americans bought Alaska from Russia in 1867, and that put America both north and south of British Columbia. Now, as you are doubtless aware, the railway in the end got built. But even so, even the actual particularities of it also depended on politics, very much so. There was a rebellion in Western Canada, in Manitoba and Saskatchewan in 1885, as a result of which the Canadian government sent over 4,000 militia and their supplies west over the section of the Canadian Pacific Railway that had already been built. And what that did was showed that the railway was absolutely crucial in order to maintain control of any bit of Canada that might rebel. And this display of capability was followed by a new increase in government subsidy for the Transcontinental Railway, and it enabled its completion that year in 85, although trains didn't run until 86. This railway was a formidable engineering achievement, particularly through the Rockies. A key issue, of course, being the climate. While much of the labour was provided by about 17,000 Chinese workers, although not surprisingly, they didn't feature in the last spike photograph. At least 600 of the Chinese died, many as a result of landslides or the unsafe use of explosives. And as in other countries, the Chinese were paid less than the other workers. So in other words, in Canada, by 1886, you're having trains running across the continent, Vancouver, in fact, being incorporated as a city and renamed Vancouver in 1886 when the first transcontinental railway arrived. It was the terminus. And this is a major achievement for the British Empire, but one that had been shot through with political imperatives. We're now going to briefly talk about Australia and then a bit greater detail look at India. The first Australian railway opened in 1831. It was a short gravitational railway. In other words, the trains along it moved as a result of moving downhill rather than through steam traction. And it was designed to service a coal mine in Newcastle, New South Wales. The first Australian steam-powered railway from Melbourne to Port Melbourne, again, a port link, didn't open until 1854, and that from Sydney to Granville following in 1855. Now, there was a totally different issue in Australia to New Zealand, for example, because in New Zealand, everything was done on one gauge. But in Australia, the key, as it were, political agency was the individual colonies, later states. And what that meant is that that individual colonies picked their own gauge. The British government advised a standard gauge, but instead New South Wales and Victoria built two different gauges. Now, you can see the same thing happening in Europe. I mean, Spain and France built to different gauges. Russia, including Russian Poland and Prussia, Germany built to different gauges. But within Australia, what this definitely did was create problems in terms of transit between the individual colonies. More positively, Australia played a key role in the development of articulated steam locomotives that were particularly suited for the hard work of colonial railways, particularly what was known as the Garratt locomotives, which proved very effective on narrow gauge lines with low load-bearing capability. So Australia doesn't have the kind of epic story you associate with Canada, and is more a matter of a series of separate railways developing. Now, the same, though for different reasons, can be said of India. In India, of course, Britain is the imperial power. There were a series of private companies who take the key role. Their shareholders were under legislation and contracts of 1849, guaranteed an annual return of 5% by the East India Company, which was the governing British body until 1858. But these companies were essentially independent. So the key ones were the Great Indian Peninsula Railway, the East Indian Railway, the Madras Railway, and the Bombay, Baroda and Central India Railway, though there were many others. And the first railway was built from Bombay, which is now referred to as Mumbai, to nearby Thane in 1853. There was a 21-mile journey, and this was treated with, you know, great drama. There was a 21-gun salute from Fort George. And from Mumbai, the railways were to be built northeast to the Ganges River and north to Surat, and separate railway systems developed out of both Calcutta and Madras. The Marquess of Dalhousie, the Governor General from 1848 to 1856, was a keen supporter of rail. And this was an example of how British initiatives were directly transferred to India, because Dalhousie had already been president of the Board of Trade in England from 1845 to 46, and he's a keen supporter of rail there, and he argued that in India, a railway would have economic, social, and political advantages. Now, you can readily emphasize each or each as if you wanted to provide only one as being the explanation. And as we know, people that write about India tend to try and look for the worst interpretation upon British action. So Dalhousie did write in 1853 that railways, quote, would enable Britain to bring the main bulk of its military strength to bear upon any given point in as many days as it would not require months, and to an extent which at present is physically impossible. But he also emphasized, as I've already argued, the economic value of it, and indeed what he saw as the social value of it, through a sort of his vision of modernizing India. He wanted lines built from the major administrative centres, which were, of course, also the major cities, Bombay, Calcutta and Madras, each of which were ports, in order to sort of bring commerce and, in his eyes, modernising civilisation into the centre. And he also backed, as again, the same changes as in Britain, the telegraph for India, as well as uniform postage. Large amounts of capital and labour were deployed, and many Indians died in the construction of railways. Now, the last point can be seen as an instance of contemporary racism, and that could then be amplified by reference to the deaths of Chinese rail workers, as I've already done. But at the same time, it needs to be pointed out that death rates in rail construction, and indeed in rail maintenance, were generally high, including, for example, in Britain. Indeed, by modern standards, very high, and that included European labour. In India, the relevant capital came from London, the relevant technology was British, much of the working labour was Indian, much of the directing labour was British. And again, you can put your emphasis where you like. I think it's fair to say that rather than trying to point score, you could say it was, like so much of empire, a joint enterprise, which is the only way that you could have effectively run empire of the character that the British were trying to do. The British, of course, also had informal empire, and you see that not just in one way of looking at it, parts of the United States with their rail system, but even more the case in Latin America, which was a major sphere of British investment. That reflected capital availability, it reflected a liberal global order, it reflected a willingness to take risk. It also reflected the very poorly developed nature of local capital markets and liquidity. And what that did was mean that, bluntly, they needed to get in capital from elsewhere. So, for example, a prime instance was the Central Uruguay Railway, which was established in London to take over a railway in the same name, founded in Uruguay, but which had lacked sufficient capital to both operate and then expand, and so on elsewhere. Growth in Uruguay, in Argentina, in Brazil, in Chile, all of them reflected the availability of British capital. Now, it would be mistaken to think that only the British were involved. There was other Western European investment, particularly in Argentina, and American investment was important in particular in Mexico, notably from the end of the century. But much of the rest of the continent, the British investment in rail was crucial. And interestingly enough, if you play forward into the 20th century, the relative decline of rail in favour of air and lorry, or the Americans would say truck links, by the mid-20th century is linked to the spread of American influence and the decline of British ones. I mentioned last time the American enthusiast who wanted the capital of world empire to be based in Denver, where it was going to be at the center of a railway system that spanned the Bering Straits. Well, they're at a very different level, and showing that, that railway, as it were, inspired all sorts of thoughts. There were the bold plans for a Pan-American railway, notably as a result of advocacy by a chap called Hinton Rowan Helper, who lived from 1829 to 1909. He was a Southerner, but he was an opponent of slavery, and he was an American consul in Buenos Aires from 1861 to 69. He proposed what he called the Three Americas Railway, the title of a book he published in 1881, and his ideas were taken up by American politicians, principally as a way to limit British influence, notably James Blaine, who was Secretary of State in 1881 and then from 1889 to 92, and also by Presidents Benjamin Harrison and Teddy Roosevelt. And the scheme was pushed in the first International Conference of American States in 1890. The Pan-American Railway was part of the American wish for a customs union, whilst, not surprisingly, given the way in which a lot of ideas were advanced in a eugenicist fashion in the late 19th century, Helper also saw it as a means to help ensure what he wanted, which was a white hemisphere. In the railway, in his book, he declared that surpassing railway, once well constructed and in operation, will indeed make America the new world, a world so conspicuously new and superior in its natural riches that its attractions to the peoples of the old world would be absolutely overwhelming. What he essentially wanted to do, and you get the same thing in Brazil and Argentina, was to have a sort of vision of modernization which would encourage white immigration from Europe, and that would then mean that the Americas were less non-white. In practice, there was considerable opposition, notably in Argentina, to what was regarded as an aspect of American imperialism, and the Pan-American Railroad was never built. By the 1920s, Pan-Americanism remains a significant theme in American sort of public culture about foreign policy. By the 1920s, Pan-Americanists were emphasizing road construction rather than rail. And as you may know, there is a road most of the way, though in the Isthmus of Panama, east of the Panama Canal, an area I visited, there is no road link, and I can't quite see, noting the terrain, how very waterlogged and very forested. I can't see them ever building it. And anyway, it's redundant in economic terms. More modestly in scale, there were also continuing developments in Europe that reflected attempts to, as it were, overcome the environment. Now, there are headline achievements, notably lines under the Alps, where the Mont-Cenis tunnel, rail tunnel between France and Italy, was completed in 1871. In the 18th century, tourists were carried across the Mont-Cenis pass by the equivalent of sedan chairs by local porters. From 1871, they're going through by train under the mountains. And the Gotthard Pass follows in Switzerland in 1882. The Alps pose major problems for the development and operation of a rail system. Roads can take gradients that are impossible for railways, and gradients which ease the passage of railway of mountain ranges can also do switchbacks much more easily. Railways, of course, can attempt to hug the valley bottoms, but this was difficult when you've got what you might call, if you pardon the expression, wet bottoms. A dry bottom, of course, is less of a problem, but a wet bottom, because of rivers being in spate when the snow melts, is a real problem, while on top of that, many valley bottoms were narrow, rocky, and already in use for other purposes. Tunnelling was an alternative, and that was made easier in the late 19th century, as indeed was rail construction as a whole, by what you might call the dynamite revolution. in the sense that in place of gunpowder, you get more nitroglycerin and other explosives that are more effective, although they're still very expensive and dangerous, with many workers killed. Moreover, if you use high explosive, the daily volume of rock that you've then got to move away grows in scale. Aside from construction problems, those of maintenance were also more serious in Switzerland than in warmer climates. Ice and freeze thawing affects the rails. Snow melt floods the rail bed. Snow was a major issue in running the trains. The fact that despite all of this, there was still the expansion of the Swiss rail system and then Swiss links with neighbouring countries was a testimony to the determination to try and overcome engineering problems and to the finance available. And the total length of European rail track in kilometres increases enormously. In 1860, it had been 51,900. By 1880, it's 169,000. So that's a factor of more than three. By 1900, it's in 283,000. Now, most was in Western and Central Europe, but other areas, notably Spain, Portugal, Scandinavia, and indeed Southeast Europe, sees an expansion. In 1871, the first train steams out of Constantinople, Istanbul. The Orient Express is established in 1883. The first direct train initially goes to the port of Varna in Bulgaria, and there's ferry links and boat links. But in the first direct train to Constantinople, left Paris in 1889. Although it's worth bearing in mind that what most people think of as the Orient Express is not that train. Instead, it's the Simplon Orient Express, which ran via Venice, but that doesn't develop till after the opening of the Simplon Tunnel in 1919. But by 1889, Paris to Constantinople is a rail service, just as other long-term rail services are developing. The Paris-St. Petersburg Nord Express starts in 1896. The Paris-Lisbon Sud Express was launched in 1887 and extended to London, in other words, to Calais, and then a special boat service in 1888. Now, this was a Europe linked for the elite, but also many others as never before. And the speed of these trains obviously depends upon the length of the train and how many engines you put on. That first train I mentioned from Mumbai to Thane had three engines, for example, which answers the question of how fast they can go. A lot of it depends upon how much load they're pulling. But what you've got is, I think it's fair to say, a European system, a system that is present in some, but by no means all, of the European colonies. And we're going to talk next time, after some questions, we're going to talk about the more precarious development of rail in Africa, for example. And we've also got, as we discussed, some of the more extraordinary examples, such as the Pan-American Railway, the extent to which rail involved what I've referred to as hustlers. The hustlers of political projection, their economic counterparts, and the would-be commercial implementers. And what is interesting about in hustle in this period is the ready availability of risk capital for plans, both plausible and less so. So was the what appeared to be the certainties of profit and political advantage from a new technology, and in the face of what was limited regulation of fares and a governmental oversight that was generally positive. Now, these contingencies were to suffer as a result of experience, as a result of capital crises, such as the one we referred to last week, in America in 1873, and to changing fundamentals as you start to get overcapacity in some areas and as profitability declines. But I think it's fair to say that if you were catching one of these great long-term expresses, you would have thought things were absolutely fantastic. As I've said, we are going to show next time that reality was, as you would expect, more complex. Over to you, Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I feel we've travelled a lot of the world in what you've been saying. I'm very interested in your comments on the efforts to create a trans-American a railroad system, the Free Americas railways you spoke about. And obviously, as you say, that didn't come to pass. But I wonder to what extent, you know, if I had wanted to travel by rail, let us say, right towards the end of the 19th century or right at the end of the century, if I'd wanted to travel from Buenos Aires through up into either British Columbia or Quebec, you know, obviously I'd be having to change railway companies and change trains and so on. But how much of that journey, despite making these changes, could I do by rail? Where were the real gaps where it would have been impossible and I'd have to find other means to go from Argentina up into Canada?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I'm afraid you would have found it quite difficult because there are links between the Argentine and Uruguayan system. There are links between the Argentinian and Chilean system. And there are links between the Argentinian and the Uruguayan and Brazilian, and indeed the Argentinian and Brazilian systems. But then we have to pause. The northern part of South America has limited development of rail in Colombia and Venezuela and Ecuador and northern Brazil, a matter of terrain topography, forest cover. The bulk of the northern Chilean and Peruvian railways are in fact there in order to deal with mineral extraction. So they're not there in order to provide, links north-south. I mean, I've got a little bit here on Peru. It sought to link its coastline to the interior, but the gradients posed by the Andes were really difficult. So from Lima on the coast, the railway went up to 4,783 meters. That's three times the height of anywhere in Britain. On the line finished in 1908, a line, incidentally, that plays the role in Tintin's story, Prisoners of the Sun. But there's no comparable line north from Peru to Ecuador, or indeed from Peru eastwards into Brazil. In Mexico, I mean, as I mentioned, in Central America, there is the Panamanian line, 1855, from the Caribbean to the Pacific. There aren't north-south lines. In Mexico, 1882 sees the first rail link between Mexico and America, and which is the Atchison, Topeka and Santa Fe Railroad, the Mexican Central Railroad, following in 1884, and a line from Mexico City to Texas across the Rio Grande that year. So it's only really from Mexico northwards that you could really move. And I think it's fair to say there are rail links between the United States and Canada, but they're modest in scale. And so therefore, if you were going, as you asked, from Buenos Aires to you wanted to go to British Columbia, I would have two suggestions to you. My major suggestion would be, if it was the summer, to go to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and get on a train and go all the way across Canada. If it was the winter, when you can have ice flows off Nova Scotia, I would, although Halifax is in theory, you know, a port most of the year round, I would go as far north as New York and go westwards via Chicago and then join the Canadian system. The other way you could do it if you like, going through the Roaring Forties, was to go around Cape Horn and up the western side of South America, which would probably be the quickest route, actually, but that would depend on sailing conditions. Well, you would obviously be in a steamship, but what one would call sailing conditions.
That's very, very interesting indeed. I was also fascinated by your comments about the strategic importance of the railway system in Canada and the way in which the British government underwrote a lot of the key investment. Were there successful attempts by American companies to nevertheless invest in the Canadian networks, or was that made very difficult for them?
No, I mean, what's interesting, and you can see it to the present day, when it was the two major Canadian companies that bid for the Kansas company, which has just been sold to one of the Canadian bidders. There was links, quite good links, and of course, through the same system you get in Britain, which is transit rights across lines, so that you get, as it were, revenue sharing, which encourages investment. But in essence, the Canadian system is constructed by the Canadian government with British encouragement, was an east-west system. So that the idea, whereas today, if you think about the economic links, British Columbia to a considerable extent is part of an economic zone with Washington State. Alberta is part of an economic zone with the Rocky States to the south, Montana, Wyoming, and so on and so forth. Ontario with the Midwest, the Maritimes with Maine. That was not the prime logic of rail. There were links, particularly on the eastern seaboard. And there was obviously economic and actually demographic links. A lot of British migrants to Canada then went on and migrated to the United States. But nevertheless, the Canadian system is not really integrated, in part, I would say, for because of reasons of imperial preference, which I think is an important aspect. So I would see it as two separate systems. External American investment is more common, as I've just indicated, in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. The investment, particularly by Britain, but also by other foreign countries in South America's rail network, obviously that becomes controversial in the 20th century. I'm thinking particularly of Juan Perón's campaign against the British-owned railways. When these railways were laid down, though, with foreign money, was there much political opposition on the grounds that these are foreigners seizing our opportunities? Or at the time, was it seen as a godsend of foreign money opening up the economic possibilities of these South American countries?
Well, I think what one could fairly say, Graham, is you see both, which in a way is what you would expect. I mean, there are some of the key, one of the key entrepreneurs in Argentina is a man called Thomas Brassey, who 1805 to 17, he plays a major role in the development of Argentina's railways. And of course, one of the whole points of the railways, one of the reasons why people are keen on them, is that, as with Uruguay, exactly the same, the key product that is being moved is cattle from the Pampas, in the case of Argentina, but also from Uruguay, to British markets. So if you think about that astonishing range of beef products, you got what from 1899 was trademarked as OXO, as well as corned beef, which was trademarked as Fray Bentos in 1881. Now, both of those come from Uruguay, and both of them come from, and Uruguay is getting its money essentially by flogging cattle to the Brits, or beef products to the Brits. And of the £36 million invested in Uruguay by 1900, foreign investment, £11 million was in railways, you know, which gives you an idea of the significance. So some people, yes, don't like it. And you can always find what you might refer to these days as populist politicians. And many of them obviously ring the changes on how awful the British are. But the reality is anybody that was sensible understood that there was a need for foreign capital, not least because of the limited liquidity of states of that period, and which meant that there was a reliance on foreign capital sources. Incidentally, the major competition for the Brits in Argentina to assert, well, yeah, I would say it's the major competition, was that, you know, the French, for example, the French open a rail line between Rosario and Puerto Belgrano in 1910. So they're pressing hard. Argentina has the seventh largest rail system in the world by 1900. So in many senses, it's part of the British railway empire. And to give you an idea, the capital investment in Argentine railways was 8.1 million in 1875, but by 1895 it was 96.2 million. I mean, this is an enormous amount. Argentina's taking about 40% of the British investment in Latin America, and about a third of that investment is in railways. I mean, they're also investing, for example, in government bonds and indeed in the production of beef. And as you may know, one of the lasting influences of British rail companies in Latin America is football. I mean, football was introduced in both Argentina and Uruguay by the British companies and the British workers.
Mm-hmm. Well, that may be another story for another day. We will have to leave it there on railways and railroads for there, but for taking us through their developments in India, Australia, Switzerland, and the Americas, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.